This is Jason. You're listening to Clever Creature. It's an experimental variety show and a creative leap of faith. Each episode starts with a word randomly picked by an algorithm. I write and produce a story and a song about the word. I sit down with a guest to talk about the random word and also about creative risk-taking. And because I'm a 90s kid, there's a bonus track, a short guided meditation at the end of each episode. If you like what you're hearing, you can help the show by rating or reviewing it on iTunes, Spotify, Himalaya, or wherever else you listen. And because algorithms rule the world, it really helps us get noticed if you leave a comment or rate us. This project is dedicated to my sister, Mary Hamilton, who was always so much braver than me. And I want to give extra special thanks to my son, Emre, who composed and plays the theme music. Okay, let's get going. Season one is 8 episodes, every other Tuesday from May to August. This is episode 7, Fail.
Of all the dung beetles, I am the most industrious. Consistently, mine are the largest and roundest dung balls, and I am very selective about seeking out the dung with the highest possible nutritional content for the colony. This significantly increases our chances of survival relative to other colonies. Maple is envious because she is lazy. Instead of being strategic about it, she just seethes and makes excuses. "The rains will not relent," she says at the height of the rainy season. "The dung is too wet for rolling." Never mind the fact that I have anticipated this eventuality, making a dry shelter from a log and leaves, and stockpiling ample amounts of fresh dung for later rolling. Never mind the care I took to choose the perfect log, measuring the thickness of the walls between the hollowed-out center and the outer bark, and noting the porousness of the wood. It's a humidor. The humidity inside is consistently perfect for rolling during the rainy months. Maple sees none of this, of course. Her whole being is consumed with the notion that the world is a conspiracy against her and that I, her own brother, am bent on profiting from her misfortune.
Today is the day. Today is the day that I will show that smug, superior brother of mine that he isn't so special after all. All of those Sisyphus awards he's got piled up in his sleep chamber, year after year of winning the golden poo for his oh-so-perfect dung balls, everyone's like, "Maple, poor Maple, when will she get her shit together?" Henrik, there's more to life than rolling the perfect dung ball. All these months, I've spent trapped in this toxic self-image, thinking I was nothing because I couldn't leap out of bed every morning like you, with a hard-on for rolling dung. There's a word for this state that I've been in. Depression. Since I first emerged from my incubator ball, all I've ever heard is Henrik this, Henrik that. All I've known is that I just wasn't good enough.
I'm grateful that I have my health and my strength, and that my industry and intelligence is such that I can provide for Maple and for so many others who lack these traits. Really, I have nothing to complain about. I could ask for nothing more than the simple pleasure of rising each day, parting my elytra, revealing my flying wings and flying several miles in search of the perfect dung pat. I take great joy in the cycle of the seasons and in adjusting my strategies to tackle new challenges. In short, I live to work, and I work to live. What else is there?
I think the part that hurts the most is knowing that even if I pull this off, no one will appreciate it. They all think like Henrik. He is their hero. Well, Chitra understands. If it wasn't for Chitra, I could never have come this far. So many times when I was falling to pieces, stung by some casual insult of Henrik's, Chitra took me aside and said, "Girl, you've got to let them go. The harder you hold on to them, the deeper they've got their leg spurs into you. You want to be their dung ball? You want to let them mold and shape you? Or you want to be like me and let your freak flag fly?" Chitra's so brave. She doesn't care what anybody thinks. I want to let my freak flag fly, Chitra. I want to let it fly.
Maple's up to something. I prioritize consistent sleep. It gives me the energy and equanimity I need for my work. But lately I've been hyper-vigilant, waking up at the slightest sound. I'm worried about her, I suppose. Though why I should allow her chaos to disrupt my well-being, I couldn't say. More than once I've heard scraping sounds at odd hours, or found her chamber empty when she should have been resting. Today, I followed her scent to the base of a tree. A tree! The trail led straight up the trunk, straight up into the highest branches. Dung beetles don't climb trees. We are the stewards of the earth, born of the dung and bound to return to it. Born of the dung and bound to return. Of course, I didn't follow her. I had things to do. But it left me with a sickly feeling all day. My productivity was reduced by 12%. 12%! I rolled the dung without zest. My technique lacked subtlety. It isn't fair. I have done everything right. I have worked my legs to the core for this colony. Maple does nothing but sit on her abdomen and consume the tasty dung I provide. But apparently that's not sufficient. It's not enough to treat me as her personal slave. She has to destroy my productivity on top of it. I will not sit idly by and watch my numbers plummet. I will get to the bottom of this.
What if I fail? Since I first thought of this plan, it's like a mantra in the back of my head. There's like two voices in there, Maple Can and Maple Can't.
What if you fail, Maple Can?
What if I do fail, Maple Can't? What's the worst that could happen?
You could die.
Yeah, well, it's not like I'm doing much living as it is.
Come on, Maple Can. We're talking about death here, the big unknown. Remember Mom, just lying there on her back, baking in the sun, her legs all crisp and crowing? Remember that hideous, hairy spider that dragged her down into its hole, glaring at you with all its beady eyes as she disappeared from view forever?
Whatever, Maple Can't. I've got a plan. I'm going through with the plan.
You're just like your brother, Maple Can, sticking rigidly to the script, afraid of the slightest deviation.
What? That's exactly the opposite of what I'm like. Get out of my head!
It's my head too, you know. I cannot believe this. I am halfway up a tree. Maple doesn't know I'm following her. I heard her sneak out, and against my better judgment, I just followed. I look down on the earth, and I don't even recognize it. Where is the entrance to my lair? This is no place for a dung beetle. This is the realm of the quick scurriers, the swingers and the howlers, and the deadly ones whose flight wings never hide. Where have you brought me, Maple? Higher and higher I go, following her familiar scent, mingled with unfamiliar notes of high energy. There is fear in it, and hope.
They don't bury their eggs in dung, so when the babies are born, they're starving. I've been watching them for months, trying to learn their patterns. The babies scream and cry. They come into this world in terror, not knowing where their next meal is coming from. Soon they learn the routine. Mom flies away, she comes back with food. They settle into this rhythm and their voices get stronger, more brave. Then it's time for a whole new terror. They struggle to their feet, they test out their wings, they fly, or they crash to the earth. I call the little one Tunjai. I like him. He's got attitude. While all his brothers and sisters are freaking out, Tunjai just keeps up this steady call all day long in the direction his mom has gone.
Hey, Maple Can, you can't do this. You don't have it in you. If they catch you, it's gulp, right down the gullet.
Shut up, Maple Can't. You just watch me. I'm in stealth mode, creeping out of my leaf blind, down the trunk and out along the branch. It'll be hours before the mommy comes home. The babies are too self-involved to notice anything except their own hunger. As I approach, they keep up the racket, screaming their full heads off. Only Tunjai turns to see me as I flutter in to land on his back, just between his wing shoulders. Swiftly, I hook my leg spines deep into his down, and I'm attached.
Maple, what are you doing?
Oh God, it's Henrik. I'm letting my freak flag fly.
What does that even mean, Maple? Come home with me at once.
Come with me, Henrik. There's room for both of us.
But where are you going?
I don't know. Isn't it great?
Sister, I don't understand what's happening here. Maple, I'm afraid.
Listen, Henrik. All your life you've been afraid. And that has made you an asshole. You're very reliable, but you're an asshole.
I know.
So how about this? How about just this once, get out of the driver's seat? Listen to Maple. Get out from behind that array of mental monitors and let's see where Tunjai here can take us. What if I told you that beyond these mountains there are dung piles bigger and more fragrant than any you have ever dreamed of? What if I told you that further still, there's a world where dung collection itself is a non-issue?
Impossible.
Is it? The air is unbearably still. High above us, in the uppermost branches, a single twig snaps. Then Henrik makes an unlikely decision. Without a word, he flutters down and nestles in beside me on Tunjai's back. A moment later, Tunjai stands up. Shouldering his siblings aside, he hops to the edge of the nest and stretches out his wings. He leaps off the edge, and he's plummeting downward, The wind becomes deafening. Our dwelling hole rushes towards us, growing larger and larger. What if we fail? What if we fail? Oh, Henrik, what have I done to you? And then, with a gentle tilt and flap of his wings, Tunjai takes flight.
Okay, so yeah, I'm taping this on April 21st. Doesn't really mean that much except that it's just a few weeks to the launch of Clever Creature. Let me disentangle this mic cord. So I've been thinking about, and I've wanted to talk about sustainability. One of the conversations in this season that has made the strongest impression on me just stays with me is the one with Edgar Carret. And I've been thinking a lot about his, you know, general attitude toward life and art, and specifically something that he said about how in his work, he wants the basic message, if there is a message underneath the work, to be that for the most part, life is bearable. That as bad as things sometimes get, we are not, as he put it, we're not a race of Darth Vaders. People do bad things, terrible things, but often out of fear. And it's not someone else out there, you know, who is the terrible evil force. It's us. It's our own fear. It's our own, the mistakes that we make, quite often anyway, with all kinds of reasons, all kinds of opinions and beliefs to justify them. And that basically what we are when we're at fault is ignorant more than evil. And I'm thinking about sustainability. I'm thinking about like the long game of art and how when you're 20 years old, you know, or 16 or whatever, and you first get the idea to be an artist or to make art, it's this like all or nothing, you know, all of the imagery and often the heroes. It's this idea of burning the candle at both ends, burning brief and bright. You want to go up like a supernova and you want to do amazing things, you know. And again, going back to something Edgar said, he said, if you focus instead on doing like on having creative adventures, doing things that are fun, going into territory that you've never gone into before, then maybe something important will happen as a result of that. But when you focus all of your energy on the intensity and the importance and the passion, trying to squeeze every last drop of genius out of yourself, as opposed to just finding joy and pleasure and play in what you're doing, the chances are that you end up with something ponderous and not particularly important, maybe self-important. They don't really talk about this in art school, or they didn't in mine anyway. And they don't tell you this when you're like a young aspiring artist. You know, what about when you're 80? Would you like to still be making art? Would you like there to be the possibility of simply dipping back into that well and going somewhere new? We have all of these stories of these people who like peak early or did this extraordinary album and then who knows what they did, disappeared into obscurity or their other albums just weren't as good or whatever. And I think that what we should be, or what I want to aspire to anyway, is, I mean, the same as you would aspire for your life to be sustainable. You want to be able to enjoy your life, enjoy the people that you love. When you're 40, when you're 50, when you're 60, when you're 70, when you're 80, the life that I want is one where I'm never looking back on some past time and saying, that was the time when I was truly alive. And so if what you want is life and connectedness and awakeness throughout, how do you achieve that? What are the structures to sustain that? Like as a 20-year-old artist thinking the way that I was just talking about, you know, for me it was like drinking myself into oblivion was perfectly normal and fine because this is the energy. These are the manic mood swings. This is the passion that produces the art. You know, I have no idea, absolutely no idea whether and to what extent living intensely and destructively, self-destructively in those ways impacts the art. I mean, obviously it does. Does it make it better overall? I sincerely doubt it. But at any rate, so it was perfectly normal to have total inconsistency about having the wherewithal to sit down and make art. But if it's a joy, if it's a pleasure, if it's a thing that sustains you, then it should be something that you can come back to regularly. And so in order to do that, you need to structure your life in such a way that makes that possible. You know, and part of that, I think, is taking care of your body, exercising, eating well, trying to get enough sleep if possible. Part of that is taking care of your mind and your heart, making sure that your relationships are not totally destructive and insane, you know, that you have relative stability at home. I mean, I'm not saying there's only one way to be an artist, but I guess what I'm saying is the kind of artist I would like to be, and I'm not sure why anyone wouldn't want to be this kind of artist, has a life that makes it possible to experiment, to explore, to push the boundaries on a fairly consistent basis for as long as you've got your faculties. There needs to be financial sustainability. There needs to be maybe a schedule where you write, some people say every day, whatever it is, something you can rely on, to come back and meet yourself in that space and engage in that practice of letting go again and again into the not knowing and seeing what happens. And learning over time that no matter what I come to the table with, no matter who I am today, I can go there. I mean, I feel like that is the most powerful thing. I used to think that the power was this lightning bolt from the gods that came down to you or didn't. I think the real power is that power of the old tree or the mountain that is there day after day under differing conditions, that sees itself go through all of these transformations and that still is there. And then that becomes, I mean, not to get too pious about it or whatever, but that becomes the origin of faith, what they call faith, because having lived like that again and again, then you know that that thing is there for you. That's deep trust. So with that, let's go to the random word generator and generate random words. Go. Fail. The word is fail.
Distinguish darkness from light. I would have made it though, but for my brain, which could not stop searching for the right words to explain. What if I fail? What if I fail? What if I do? I made a mountain out of cardboard and string. I sat inside it, and I call myself the Mountain King. And it might sound lonely, but that depends on the range of creatures you're willing to think of as your friends. What if I fail? What if I fail? What if I fail? So what if I do?
My guest today is the Tony and Emmy Award-winning actress Mary Louise Parker. She's also the author of Dear Mr. You, a beautiful and wholly original memoir in letters. Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Mary Louise.
How are you?
I'm good. I'm so glad that you're doing this.
Thank you. No, thanks. I love talking to you, so...
How are you doing with all this? Are there multiple people with you at home?
Or my kids, just my kids and my dog.
How many? I have two.
I have a girl and a boy. They're 13 and 16.
So yeah. Two teenagers and mom in the house. How's that going?
I actually just thought that I should later on hold some kind of family meeting, because I keep seeing people saying you should hold family meetings and just tell everybody all the stuff I think they're doing right, because it's really
nice.
I could complain so easily, but it could just be, to say it could be 1,000 times worse is such an understatement. And right. Every time I go to the grocery store, it's like, yes, they don't have this or they don't have that, or it's so bizarre you have to wait outside, but I can pay for my groceries and I don't undervalue that. I am hyper aware every time. Yesterday I was holding my credit card and I just was so hyper aware of the fact that I could pay for the food for my kids.
It's hard, but we kind of have to hold both of those things in our mind at the same time. One, those of us that feel lucky that are able to pay for groceries, that do have a comfortable place to live, to be aware of all the people that are in the situation where they can't, that are suffering terribly from this. And at the same time, everyone is suffering from this. I mean, this is a strange thing, you know? Our lives and our kind of expectations are disrupted in ways that are taking
I don't feel like
time
I'm suffering.
To orient to.
I don't feel like I'm suffering. I feel like my life is disrupted. And I wonder what mark this will lay on my kids. I worry about my friends who live alone. I do not feel that I am suffering. At all. I cannot use that word. I mean, I feel like sometimes people will say, isn't this weird? Isn't this strange? This is so bizarre. And I do, obviously I concur, but I can't say I'm not someone who doesn't always feel that things are bizarre. I feel like I spend a lot of my time. I feel I waste a lot of time actually being preoccupied by how I'm so easily confounded by life and how can there be radiators and fried clams? And how did that person just tell me that when they just told me something else 20 minutes before? And why do I feel this now? When I feel life is just continually confounding. I mean, I'm really not just saying that. I really believe it would be really, really vulgar for me to sit here and say that I'm suffering. I'm not suffering at all. I have a roof over my head. It's touched me. You know, I lost a very, very close friend recently and, it's tragic for so many people. And it's scary because we don't know what the future holds. Someone was saying to me the other day, they think 4-year colleges, well, that won't be a thing. But I have a really close friend who, she was in her freshman year of college. And, you know, I was sort of involved with her when she was getting into school and mentoring her, and she's come home and now she's doing exercises from home. And drama school is really a bizarre thing to experience. in front of a screen.
So much of the work is about physical and direct connection.
It's entirely visceral, you know? That's the difference between the theater and film, you know? The people have to be in the seats. It's why you can't really film theater, why it always seems a little static and a little strange. You can be there in the moment and it's magical, and then they film it and it's just, it doesn't resonate.
I feel like this, all this Zooming and all of this virtual existence that we're all having to do in our professions and personal lives is gonna remind us of something about what it is to be physically close to people.
Do you think that it could potentially maybe pull people away from this kind of life?
I mean, we're so good at slipping into the daydream, right? So, you know, there will be one thing that will happen as freedoms I hesitate to use the word freedom because it puts me in mind of the people in Texas who are protesting for their freedom from being kept indoors right now.
Yeah, I'm glad they don't live in my neighborhood.
Right, me too. But, you know, as the normal range of motion is restored, I think people will behave in one way. But then, I don't know, I think we're good at forgetting, right? I mean, like, yeah. I don't know, 6 months later, a year later, like, if this isn't a recurring thing.
I wonder if people will not be a little bit more aware now that the unthinkable can happen, that a routine can sustain an extreme upset. But then you see, it was extremely hard for me to wrap my head around seeing, you know, a line up of healthcare workers standing in front of these people protesting, they're protecting your life. And it only can come down to fear. I had to really kind of mine for some kind of compassion for these people. And it can only be that they're afraid for their livelihood. They're afraid of not being able to make a living or being able to feed their kids. Other than that, I can't. There's no way for me to connect to them. And that I do sympathize with that. And I do understand, you know, and it's propaganda and it's being fed by the president of the United States, who, if you look worldwide, I mean, I'm certainly not the most politically aware or fluent person. I can't cite world events, but I don't know if anywhere else in the world there is a world leader standing up inciting that kind of drama, inciting that kind of like contention and adversarial relationship between the people who are protecting the livelihood of the other people who are protesting them. How that can be encouraged by a leader, that to me is unfathomable. He's not unfathomable to me because he's just one psycho. But the fact that there are people who support him or who can in any way make room for him or give him any credit as anything other than a buffoon or now basically a murderer, that's what I can't get. That it says 60% don't approve and 40%. Who are those 40%? Who are you? I do understand there are people who in their home, all they have is Fox News. Okay, so I blame Fox News because you have jobs. The people who are sitting there watching it, I can't blame them. I can't fault them. But the people who are putting that on the air, those are the people that I feel they are criminal. That's just morally reprehensible to me. That I can't get my brain around.
I hate to say, but I've sort of given up trying to get my brain around the whole thing. I know that we are so susceptible to propaganda at the level of certain national themes. Like, it's just astonishing. It's so Orwellian and crazy that you can associate freedom in a tweet. You can associate freedom with the right to put yourself and everybody else at risk. For sure, I can be compassionate about people being afraid for their livelihoods, and that is one thing. But it's another thing, and I think a separate thing that gets mixed in with this passion for freedom and the idea that your freedom is being threatened on an existential level, him being able to say that and then basically create a smokescreen where people can't even see what that means in terms of health, in terms of those healthcare workers.
Yeah, that you can call on the word liberate as though them being restrained from something is punitive.
Right. And who's the enemy? Doctors? The CDC? Who is the villain?
It's just about so he can get votes in those states.
Yeah. So shifting things a bit, one of the things that we talk about is creative risk taking. Different times in life and career when you've found yourself at the edge of a point of growth and known that it was time to do something that you weren't sure you were totally ready to do, but that you felt was right at the same time. And then what happened after?
Basically, for me, a risk just means you don't know what the outcome will be. So Everything is a risk. In theater, that's always the case because you can't walk out on a stage and know what's going to happen. Now, there's like, right. I would say the whole cornerstone of my philosophy about theater and theater acting is about trying to make that show exist that night in the freshest, most sprung way possible. So that means being willing to forego knowing what might ensue if I go this way in favor of going this way, because this feels like this is where I should go tonight.
I feel like we're all a lot of different people. And obviously on stage, you're pretending to be other people, but from day to day, from moment to moment, you know, we are so many people. And what is the balance, if there is one, between being open in those ways that you're talking about and then the possibility that like who you are or where you are at that moment doesn't bring the energy that you want or think you want? Or do you just have to trust that it's going to be there?
Well, you have to know that it can't be about what you want or that outcome in that moment. You have to dial back farther than that. I think if you're focused on the outcome, then it's not a risk. You know,
gotcha.
if you're right in that very, like that hot second, that moment, you can't be focused on the outcome. I did this play a couple years ago and I did three productions of it. And somewhere around the second production of it, I came home one night and I felt like, okay, like that's somewhere around what I've been heading for. And that took 34 years. At that point, 33 years, actually, at that point. Or 32? I can't even describe it because it would just be too existential and I wouldn't even want to. I mean, everyone would be asleep if they're not asleep already. But I think it took all those years for me to keep going there. And it's not something that I feel like, oh, I can do it every night or even know what it is. It's just, I don't know, I just think... my car has a better engine now. It's not like, I mean, it's a little broken down, it's a little dusty, but I understand it more when I'm out there and I know what to let go of. And I know what to let go of as part of it. In life, I have that problem too, of like being in this moment. Sometimes I'm so encumbered by what happened already, you know, not so much as what's going to happen, but what's happened already. And on stage, you can't really carry that with you. You have to carry some of it with you, but...
Right. I was going to say, like, if you're being the character...
You can't carry it with you, your judgment of it. You as the actor can't, like, haul that around with you on stage. It's like hauling it around in life, which I, you know, can do sometimes and rework the same moment over and over that I know I'm never going to get to the end of. I know I'm never going to figure out this moment or why this happened to me or why this happened to that person or why this person became, I'm never going to figure that out. Why do I keep rehashing it?
It seems like it's an intuitive process that you like feel your way through that you can't really come at very much through words.
Yeah, but it's coming with a lot of technique also, and a lot of, it is cerebral as well, but I don't even know how to describe it without sounding like super pretentious. But my friend Johanna Day, who I've done a bunch of plays with, she said, you know, to like for her theater is like church. And I believe that also there is something to it. There is a reverie to it when everyone, because it is, like I said, an equation. It's the audience. You have to have the audience, even if there's just one person. It's the communion between everyone. And there's not a lot of places in life anymore where you can do that, where the people don't have phones. Sometimes people do whip them out in the theater, but we're not going to talk about those people. So there's not a lot of places where people sit quietly without their phones, not thinking about the past or the future, trying to become engrossed in something that's happening in front of them that they are not necessarily passive to, but in some ways passive to and still involved in.
Yeah, but I mean, it's a balancing act. It's a thing that doesn't make sense in literal language, that you are trying to be completely in the moment. And at the same time, there are layers of your mind that are doing other things. You have to be aware of the character, have to be, some part of you has to be aware of where this is headed. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think when life is at its best, that's the same thing. I mean, you're utterly in the moment. You know, I think that's how we are supposed to live, or that I am trying to live.
Yeah, it's hard, right?
Yeah, yeah, it's hard. But it's the work that's most worth doing.
When you have all those things, all those engines fire, like everything, as you said, all those layers working, and within that, you find some moment of complete freedom. It's pretty awesome. And the last play that I did was so technically difficult. It was the most arduous play I've ever done.
What play? Which
play?
It
was called The Sound Inside. And it was, you know, a massive amount of text. And for the whole beginning of the play, I was by myself on the stage, just speaking, not with any pyrotechnics, just kind of me. And I would say it was when I went on stage the first time with that play, it hadn't even been fully rehearsed. And it was the least equipped I've ever felt. And it was pretty terrifying. And I just told myself just to walk to this light, this tiny pool of light on the stage. I was just like, just walk to that light. And I thought about my dad a lot, how he would just go forward when he just, even when he was in the war and he was shot, he just kept walking. I was like, just walk to that pool of light. Like, you can do that. There've been a few times in my life, many times actually, I was just completely convinced, totally sure that what I was doing was not going to be well received. People were going to hate it, but I was like resolved to it. I was like, I understand people are not going to like this, but I'm going to do it anyway. And sometimes those were the things that people seemed to respond to the most. Sometimes they were the things where people did not, but you can't really do it for that either way.
I was thinking about what you said about freedom. It seems to me that that freedom is the reason for doing the thing.
Oh, yeah.
But in the moment to moment, in the day to day, it has to be about, as you said, just stepping into the spotlight. You can't be after that freedom. I mean, that's the weird paradox. Like, if you're, if you're trying to grab that freedom, like, it's running away from you, right?
Well, this particular play, it was so technical, and I really gave myself permission in so many ways to allow for, like, if I can only get through the mechanics of these particular moments, that's fine. This has to be heard by the audience. This needs to be understood. If I'm not going to feel something transcendent necessarily ever during this play, that's fine. And ultimately that did come in waves, and often alone on stage by myself, which I've never experienced before. And the only other time I've done a direct address, I felt really ill-equipped and did not feel like I did it fully or comfortably or well. So when I felt like I was able to find that, that was pretty great. And I guess there's something, some metaphor to that, of that I was able to achieve it by myself that I should probably hold on to, because I was always dependent on something happening between two people.
Maybe we can talk a little more about freedom.
You're just off yourself and you're in yourself at the same time. I think we're so enslaved by our lives and what we want and what we want tomorrow. And this experience, you can't, somebody said to me, you almost have to look at this as a war, like just today, just this hour. And that sort of dramatizes it in a way, which I think, as I told you at the beginning, I'm sensitive to, because I do not feel right now that I'm suffering in any way. You know, I feel that I'm so lucky.
Right, right.
But I've been doing this little movie with a bunch of quarantine teens, because I used to have a drama camp in the summer with kids, teenagers.
Oh, cool.
I started when
cool,
they were like 11-ish, and with my kids and their friends. And in the middle of this, I thought, well, why don't I find some way for them to be together? So we made this little movie. We're making another one. So today I'm thinking about writing that next episode with my son and finding this book for my daughter that she wants. And how am I going to fix that pie that I tried to make last night that didn't really work? And I'm just only thinking in terms of that and getting the dog back to the vet. I'm not thinking about, oh, what if like this doesn't work for me and nobody likes me. I can't make this work. And why am I not like here in my life, and I didn't achieve that. I failed at this and I failed at that. And there's something about that that's an enormous relief. And I'm philosophically kind of Chekhovian in that way, that I feel like people need to work, people need to be occupied, and specifically at our best when we're working for, in service of others in some way. Even if that means like I'm going to go work at Chipotle to bring home money to my kids.
It's a cliche and it's an assumption, I think, in a lot of people's minds that a lot of people who go into the performing arts are looking for, you know, some part of them is looking for that kind of attention on themselves.
I think in some cases it's probably true, but in the theater, I mean, look, there's no money in theater. Like, you can't get paid. You don't get tons of attention. I've done plays that went really well that people remember. Nobody in middle America, nobody knows about them. Nobody, if I wanted attention when I was 30 or 31, I would, you know, have slept with a senator. I wouldn't have done How I Learned to Drive. You know, it's not like, that's not the way to get people to theater. It's too hard. If you're going to do that 8 times a week for attention, you're out of your mind. I was looking at my baby book the other day that my mom kept when I was little, and it says, a stranger approached her, tried to touch her cheek. Mary Louise reached out and swatted at the woman's hand. I did not ever want people to look at me. I still don't like that kind of attention necessarily. And I understand that that's hard for people to believe. I completely understand that. I would be suspicious of it also if I didn't do it for a living and didn't understand that it's an extremely effective place for me to hide. As a person, I would understand being like, oh, she doesn't mean that. She's an actress, blah, blah, blah. But it is 100% the reality for me.
Well, I know we have to wind up, but the word of the episode, the word is fail. And so then we do a kind of just Rorschach thing where I throw the word out and whatever it connects to for you.
I first thought of that Kathleen Edwards song, Failure. But I know that's nothing to do with anything here. But I just think everything is a risk, as I said. I think Justin Vernon said, you know, when he was writing for Emma, that most of his friends didn't understand it. You know, they were like, what is this? You know, I think a lot of things are like that. People didn't get it the first time or didn't know why they were doing it. And I remember like one time when I was like particularly like eviscerated for something I'd done that I knew was risky, but I still, you're not prepared for people to kind of like chop you up into little pieces and sort of seem to be enjoying that so much. I was in my apartment. I remember I was like in literally under the covers and I was talking to Mike Nichols on the phone because that's who I would call if I felt like I just couldn't. He quoted me like word for word reviews that he got when he was in his 20s. And at that point, you know, he was a man in his 70s and he remembered these horrible things people had said. And he was like, you know, you are what you are because we don't know what you're going to do. And you don't always know what you're going to do. And I'm reminding you of that because you know that, or you wouldn't be somebody who does it that way. And it's true. It doesn't mean it's not hurtful when people are telling you that you failed. And it doesn't mean that you failed when people tell you that you failed. There's no real marker for that. There's no definition. There's no person who comes up with a formula and says, okay, here we have it in our meter here that you have achieved failure. There's no...
I think about, you know, Paul Simon and that musical, The Cape Man, who's the music I love so much. And like when it closed on Broadway, it devastated him and he had to go down to the like Amazonian jungle and just take ayahuasca for 6 months to try to get through that. No, I mean, I guess the question becomes then over the long, you know, what it is that keeps you taking the risk.
Well, you just almost said it. You started to say it and then you stopped. You went for the long. And I think there is something because I was just remembering a moment when I came backstage at intermission for something that was just going particularly badly. And I'd just been reminded every day of how wrong everything I was doing was on every level. And I just fell to my knees and just cried all the way through intermission. And did that feel bad at the time? Absolutely. It was for a number of different reasons. Was that wrong? No. Do I regret that that happened? Not at all. Do I regret any of that happening? No. I mean, that experience is so layered and so many great things came out of it. I also don't ever look at my performances as a moment. I think of them as a thing that's growing, and the first performance is very different from the last in a million ways, a million ways. And if they aren't, then I wouldn't want to do it. So it is more comprehensive and there is no beginning and there is no end. I think it's somebody said, Ethan Hawke, I ran into him recently, and we were talking about theater and we were talking about our work and things, certain things. And he just said the most beautiful thing he'd read, and I think Paul Scofield's obituary, something that he said, my maker sees what I do, my work. And he said, whenever he feels like some part of his ego is involved and, oh, I wish somebody had seen that moment or that show or that. And if you do theater enough, you know that, like, in the course of a week, you feel like, oh, like you feel so many different levels of failure and success. But he said he felt like there was something higher that was watching him, and that whatever he'd achieved, whatever truth that he really had worked for from the purest part of himself, he felt like it was received somehow. And that to me is circular. It's not, there's no end point. There's no finish line. There's no finish line. There's just no finish line.
And that's it for our official episode 7 program. If you've got 10 to 15 minutes, please stick around for the bonus track, a short guided meditation. Join us next week for the blockbuster last episode of season 1. My guest is the Newbery Medal winning graphic novelist Jerry Craft, and my son Emre is back for his acting debut and to ask Jerry a couple of questions of his own. If you like what you're hearing, I'd love to hear from you. You can email me through my website, jasongotz.com, or join our Facebook group, Friends of Clever Creature. So, the first thing, the main thing always, I think, in meditation is checking in with where you're at. In the Thai forest tradition, at least as it was translated to the West by teachers like Ajahn Sumedho, there's a repetition of the phrase sometimes in meditation. It's like this. It's like this. Which is, I think, to say that the dharma of any given moment, the set of causes and conditions, the motion, the change, the complex character of any given moment or instance of reality is unlike any other. And part of the work that we do in meditation is learning to see that, which is also always a process of letting go. Letting go of the thoughts, the frameworks, the impulses to action, productivity, the living in the past and the future that frames this ever-changing experience, continually labeling it, filing it away, deciding what use to make of it or can be made of it, if any. The work here is learning what it means when we set that aside. And we see reality as it is. This is one meaning of the word dharma. The unfolding dharma of ourselves and the world. Take one deep breath in. And let it go. One more. And let it go. Find a posture that is both upright and relaxed. Can put your chin to your chest, and then kind of allow the head to float up to upright, imagining an invisible string at the crown pulling upward as gravity allows the shoulders and the rest of the body to hang, to pull downward off the skeleton. Find stillness. And to the extent that it's possible, find a posture and a position from which it's possible not to move. Tune into the breath. Notice where you naturally feel it most prominently. It's okay if that changes. For me, right now it's at the nostrils. Try to observe the breath as a separate rhythm, something that's yours and not yours. Notice the difference in sensation as it comes in and as it goes out. If something else catches your attention, here there are cars rushing outside, it's warm. Allow your attention to go to those sensations for a moment, to each sensation. If it's helpful, you can use a tool called labeling. Just label it twice. Cars, cars. And then return to the breath. If you do decide to label, keep it to one word, keep it simple. Don't worry about whether it's the right label. Warm, warm. And then return the attention to the breath. We're used to thinking of training as something difficult. Something that requires struggle and pain. This is training. But it can be done. Maybe it's best done with love and gentleness. The mind wanders. We bring it back. Calmly, gently, with no regret. And over time, we habituate. To this kind of attention. Notice the body. Maybe a slight adjustment is necessary to return to that lightness and energy of posture. Try to take in the whole energetic field of the body. Not arms or legs or head or neck, not skin, toenails, but the whole ambiently humming beehive of cells. Your consciousness not disembodied in the head, but connected to the whole network of neurons, the whole vast web. Of the energetic body. Rest lightly in this. Open to it. Welcome it in. A phrase I find helpful here is welcome, friend. Welcome, friend. Welcome experience in all of it. Good and bad. Welcome it. If a response is necessary, that's fine. Welcome doesn't mean blind. Acceptance. Welcome all experience in. See it. Know it. Put aside the mind that says, yes, but. Welcome, friend. And then, when you're ready, we're going to open our eyes gently and welcome in the visual field, the light, and what the day brings us. Welcome, friend.